A nuclear war is totally unacceptable to everybody. Somebody has to talk to Kim.
Duterte presses North Korean threat. It's Tuesday, October 31st. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, some Cambodians may be deported from the United States. Representation for Aborigines. Has the Asia pivot passed? Flying help to heart attack victims and White House ghosts. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, preparing to visit Japan, said it is time to tell North Korean leader Kim Jong-un no one wants to threaten him or destroy his country, despite his banned nuclear and missile programs.
A nuclear war is totally unacceptable to everybody. And somebody has to talk to Kim Jong-un. All leaders agree that he is a dangerous man. You must remember that he is a leader of his people. It would be good if America, Japan, Korea, and Mr. Kim Jong-un to talk and to convince him to sit down on a round table and just tell him that nobody is threatening him, that there will be no war.
The North Korean threat will be on Mr. Duterte's agenda when he meets Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and later President Donald Trump during Mr. Trump's Asia trip next month. The Philippine leader on Sunday promised to deal with the new U.S. leader in, quote, the most righteous way, and said he will listen to him and provide what he called calibrated responses. The Philippine leader often used profane language in reacting to U.S. criticism of alleged rights abuses during his war on illegal drugs by the previous Obama administration. Stephen Rood, a visiting fellow at the Australian National University and an analyst with the Asia Foundation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Duterte's relations with Washington have improved during the first year of the Trump administration.
President Duterte certainly anticipates a much more congenial interaction with President Trump than he had anticipated with President Obama. And from all reports from their interaction thus far via phone, it does go that way. So I think that's why he's saying that if he's not challenged or if there's not something to get his back up, he won't be using the rather salty language that he often does.
As you know, he was in Beijing. About a year ago, he announced his separation from the U.S., declaring he had realigned with China. How's that going?
In some ways, it's really a reversion back to the previous practice of the administration before his immediate predecessor, where President Arroyo was much closer to China than President Aquino subsequently became. And furthermore, it is certainly an exaggeration to talk about a separation in as much as the cooperation between the U.S. and the Philippines was certainly on display during the battle for Marawi City, where the United States was helping to provide intelligence and supplies so that it was possible to retake the city.
Mr. Duterte defended his 16-month-old campaign on drugs, telling Southeast Asian lawyers at a gathering in Manila that he had been demonized and denying allegations of state-sponsored killings of drug dealers and users.
He certainly has always made that his signature campaign, and he has also been very assiduous to make sure that there is no direct connection between the state direction and the way the drug war is carried out. On the other hand, such widespread killings are evidence that both the police have felt unleashed in this war and that there are others who are undertaking, perhaps under the fog of the drug war, their own kind of vigilante killings. So between the two kinds of killings, police and unattributed, we've had some 7,000 or 8,000 people killed in the last year.
Would it be counterproductive for Mr. Trump when he meets his Philippine counterpart to bring up the war on drugs and the concerns about rights?
Well, it would be a little bit unexpected because a released transcript of their phone call had President Trump telling President Duterte that he was, in fact, doing a good job in his drug war. The fact of the matter is as long as things are kept quiet and not done in public, President Duterte is indeed open to discussion, or at least to listening, as he says. But anything to be said is unlikely to change the way that things are run on the drug war in the Philippines.
Mr. Duterte is expected to discuss terrorism, drugs, and North Korea with Mr. Trump on the sidelines of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN Summit, in Manila. It runs from November 12th and 13th. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. Ship with sailors rescued at sea reaches U.S. base in Okinawa. Questions and anger after young Russian model dies in China. New Indonesian anti-communists seek elusive enemies. India's new Afghan trade route via Iran bypasses Pakistan. Pakistan and U.S. divided on how to initiate Afghan peace talks. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Many members of the Cambodian-American community may soon find themselves forced to leave their homes in the United States. Others are being rounded up in the U.S., but caught in between disagreements between the governments of the United States and Cambodia. VOA Asia's Ira Melman tried to iron out the situation by speaking first to Katrina Dizon-Matigi, the immigration policy manager of the Washington-based Southeast Asia Rescue Action Committee.
Earlier this year, there were roundups in the Cambodian community, but due to efforts of many advocates on both the Cambodia side and the U.S. side, Cambodia for a while had stopped issuing travel documents for Cambodian individuals. And the reason for this is because advocates in Cambodia have been pushing the government to work with the United States to renegotiate the current MOU between both countries that allows for the repatriation of Cambodian nationals. And basically, the objective of this would be to try to protect those that came into the country as refugees from being deported, because advocates were seeing that there were huge humanitarian concerns in deporting refugees. And as a result of this, unfortunately, the Trump administration responded by immediately issuing visa sanctions against Cambodia. So in, I believe it was September of this year, the U.S. issued sanctions on high-ranking officials of people from the Department of the Interior. And in response to this, Cambodia immediately agreed to once again start issuing travel documents. The last that we heard, the Cambodian government wanted to issue 26 travel documents, but now there's a lot of fear and concern in the community that if this is the case, why then is the United States detaining over 100 Cambodian people? And this issue has been incredibly terrifying, especially given who we have in place currently as president. And then also there's just a lot of questions and uncertainty in terms of how the U.S. and Cambodia's negotiations would look like and what would the ultimate result be and what this could mean for many Cambodian Americans throughout the country who are living in the country with deportation orders.
President Trump made it clear that anybody who is either a dreamer or a refugee, if illegal in any way, shape, or form, who has a criminal record or anything on their criminal record probably would be sent back. Are any and or all of these people burdened with any kind of criminal records?
So a majority of these folks, at least the folks that we have been in touch with, all do have criminal records. They came into the country as a refugee and lived most of their lives as lawful permanent residents, but due to a number of different factors, unfortunately, were unable to naturalize.
Has there been any kind of determination as to who goes and who stays as it applies to the severity of the charges against them?
That's a really good question, and it's a question that we have repeatedly asked DHS and ICE in terms of, ultimately who ends up getting issued a travel document and trying to figure out what criteria they even look at, because all of these cases are so different. But unfortunately, at this point, we have no idea. We were told that there is an internal negotiation process that happens between both government, and they were unable to share with us the specifics of those negotiations. So at this point, we've seen a broad range of people being deported, some with more serious crimes, and then others with smaller crimes as well. It just seems like there's really no pattern in terms of the individuals that Cambodia ultimately issues travel documents to. You know, there are thousands of Cambodians throughout the country that have been issued deportation orders due to old criminal convictions. But since Cambodia doesn't accept a huge number of Cambodians back, what ends up happening is they would be detained by ICE, issued a deportation order. But since ICE can't deport them right away, they have to release them. So they go on to rebuild their lives. A lot of them start families, they start small businesses. And mind you, these are people that have already served their sentences, so they have rehabilitated and they have completely transformed their lives. And now all of a sudden, years later, and sometimes decades later, they're suddenly caught in a situation where ICE is once again re-detaining them and trying to deport them for a crime for which they had already served their sentences.
Is this limited to the Cambodian community?
What's happening right now is not only happening in the Cambodian community, but recently over the weekend, we have heard as well that a number of Vietnamese individuals have been detained and are being processed for interview by their consulate during the next 2 weeks as well.
Ira Melman then contacted ICE, which stands for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Their spokesman, Brendan Reedy, issued a statement saying the United States continues to work with the government of Cambodia to establish a reliable processes for the issuance of travel documents and their acceptance of the prompt, lawful return of Cambodian nationals who are subject to removal from the United States. An ICE official told VOA Asia there are over 1,900 Cambodian nationals residing in the United States who are subject to a final order of removal, of whom 1,412 have criminal convictions. Happening now in Asia, Philippines Marines have been welcomed as war heroes in Manila as they returned from a five-month battle against Islamic militants in Marawi. The siege killed more than 1,000 people and devastated the city on the southern island of Mindanao. Stay up to date with VOA 60 Online. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad that you're with us today, listening to VOA Asia. Australian Indigenous leaders say a government decision not to establish an official voice in Parliament representing Aboriginal peoples is, quote, a kick in the guts. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Delegates at a landmark First Nations summit in May called on the Australian government to set up an Indigenous body to guide and shape policy towards the country's most disadvantaged people. Indigenous leaders wanted a constitutionally enshrined voice in Parliament to help establish a path to a treaty between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians. However, that idea has been rejected by the government. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull argued that an Indigenous-only representative body would be seen as a third chamber of federal Parliament in addition to the existing House of Representatives and Senate. Turnbull said most Australians were unlikely to support such a body in a national referendum because it clashed with the notion of equal rights for all. But Indigenous leaders feel let down and say the government's decision was a kick in the guts. Greens Party leader Senator Richard Di Natale says Australia's original inhabitants deserve a voice within the nation's parliament.
They want to be front and centre in decision making, and that's not a big ask. Don't do things for us, do them with us. We need to make sure that there is a strong Aboriginal voice represented in the Australian Parliament at the heart of decision making.
Aboriginal Australians make up about 3% of the national population. They suffer disproportionately high rates of poverty, unemployment, and imprisonment. It's been almost a decade since federal and state governments in Australia began a concerted effort to improve health, education and employment in Indigenous communities, but there's been limited progress in key areas. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Thailand has officially ended its year-long mourning period for its late and revered king. Many citizens who lined the streets of Bangkok for days have begun to wear color again after a year of dressing in black. Visit VOA 60 online to see this and other stories of the day, and also visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, for much of President Barack Obama's presidency, U.S. officials touted the so-called Asia Pivot, an economic, political, and military realignment toward a region seen as key to America's future. 9 months into the Trump administration, U.S. officials are taking a different approach to Asia. And as VOA's Bill Gallo reports, there are some concerned that the White House is signaling a lack of commitment to the region.
There will be no shortage of one-on-one meetings between Donald Trump and Asian leaders during his first trip to the region as president. But Trump's decision to skip a key regional summit in the Philippines may be remembered as one of the more notable parts of the trip. His absence risks upsetting U.S. allies, says Abraham Denmark, a former top East Asia official at the Pentagon.
The fact that the president will be leaving the day before the East Asia summit, I think will signal the region will see as an indication of a lack of commitment, potentially a lack of interest in Southeast Asia.
Trump's long-term commitment to Asia had already been questioned after he pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement.
You can make positive and negative arguments about TPP. It was not a net jobs creator for the United States. But what it did do is it had great strategic value. It was a marker. America was going to be here no matter what. And that's lost, and the Trump administration has not found a formula to replace that.
Instead, Trump's Asia strategy has been dominated by North Korea, leaving him little room to lay out a broader plan for the region. That could change this trip, and it won't come a moment too soon, according to Denmark.
What our partners in Asia are looking for is not whether or not the Obama policy will continue. They're looking for what is the Trump policy? What is America's policy now? And there have been some indications in various ways, but this trip gives President Trump a real opportunity to clearly explain his approach to the region.
It's a chance for America's Asian allies to find out just what America First means for them. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia, North Korean officials are celebrating the completion of the nation's first large-scale livestock farm. Ordered by Kim Jong-un to help solve the country's food shortage problem, it's not clear the farm will have a significant impact on chronic food shortages, which have plagued the reclusive nation for decades. Top stories and fun features are on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a cardiac arrest happens when the heart stops beating regularly due to mixed up electrical signals. According to the American Heart Association, when cardiac arrest occurs, every minute that passes before help arrives lowers a person's chance of surviving by 7 to 10%. However, as we hear from VOA's Kevin Enix, in a crisis when every minute counts, drones may be able to quickly get help to people who live in rural areas.
The humble drone is being considered to deliver all kinds of things, from food and medicine to your latest Amazon.com order. Soon, they may also be saving lives. The notion came to a Norwegian paramedic who was frustrated by how long it took ambulances to get to patients in rural areas.
They don't really have the opportunities of reaching
distant areas, such as islands or like the archipelago of Stockholm. And the delay is about 20, 25, 30 minutes in some cases.
But drones carrying defibrillators, devices that can reset the heart's rhythm, could be there much quicker. And those minutes could be the difference between life and death for people who suffer cardiac arrest, an often deadly condition in which the heart stops beating normally.
By placing a drone on the rooftop of a fire station, we could dispatch a drone to reach 10, 15, 20 kilometers of radius in just 5 or 6 minutes. This increases the chance of survival from about 0% to perhaps 20, 30, 40%.
It is little more than an idea right now, but initial tests have shown that drones can get to people an average of 4 times faster than ambulances. Even if it works, though, there are some significant bureaucratic and logistical challenges to the idea.
We need to be able to communicate with air traffic control using transponders. We need a network where we can use video surveillance during flight and most important during landing. Perhaps a bit more battery power as well to reach further away.
The team is planning to start a clinical study sometime next year to see if the drone deliveries can actually save lives. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Today is October 31st. That means it's Halloween, a spooky but usually fun time when many dress up in costume, children roam neighborhoods for candy and other treats, and the prevailing theme is of monsters, spooks, and spirits. The White House here in Washington has been the working and living quarters of many presidents and their families since 1800. And while she has not yet gone up to the front door to yell trick-or-treat, VOA's Nicoletta Illich reports historian Edward Lengel of the White House Historical Association says ghosts are said to reside inside this revered landmark.
For many, Halloween is a day to dress up in costumes or take children trick-and-treating. It also gives rise to thoughts about ghosts and spirits. According to historian Edward Lengel, they haunt one of the best-known buildings in the world, the White House.
The first known sighting of a ghost took place right after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in the late 1860s. During the administration of Ulysses Grant.
Lengel says there were sightings of President Lincoln and his son Willie, who had died in the White House.
There were some stories that later emerged that Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, had actually seen ghosts in the White House during the Civil War. And she claimed that she heard the ghost of former President Andrew Jackson laughing in his former bedroom.
Most ghost stories date between the Civil War and the 1930s, points out Lengel.
1897, during the presidency of William McKinley, a White House policeman was walking into the conservatory, which was a former White House greenhouse, where they grew flowers and plants and all the rest, and he had seen a light glowing in the conservatory. And so he walked in, and he turned a corner when, to his surprise, he saw an image of a beautiful woman.
When the policeman went to talk to her, she disappeared, and the light disappeared with her, says Lengel. There are some ghosts that reappeared over and over again.
Especially Abraham Lincoln. Many people have seen the ghost or claim to have seen the ghost of Abraham Lincoln, including Winston Churchill.
After World War II, there were no reports of sightings. The curator believes that one of the reasons could be
1948 to 1952, the whole inside of the White House was demolished by Harry Truman when he was renovating the White House.
Lengel says that ghosts in the White House were almost always benevolent, that there are no stories about ghosts throwing things and harming people. Also, maybe in modern times, presidents and their families do not believe in ghosts and goblins and just celebrate Halloween for fun with their guests. Nicoletta Illich, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Are you dressing up for Halloween? Let us see your costume. You can email it to us at voaasia@voanews.com or send us a message on VOA Asia Facebook. We can share it with everyone and see what kind of costume you have concocted for this wonderful, almost holiday. I came as a radio broadcaster. Director Tracy Carter came as a director. Daryl Smith came as our engineer, dressed up appropriately for the occasion. Managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, David Bird, Ira Melman are all on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.